Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, we got a fun group today.
Hey, this is going to be a lot of fun. We even have a little bit of paparazzi entourage just here observing, just getting the lay of the land. And then we have three fantastic guests that we're going to visit with. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Executive VP with the Foundation for Economic Education, Mr. Richard Lawrence. How are you, sir?
Doing great, Stone. Very happy to be here with you guys today.
Well, Richard, can you share a little bit about FEE? How are you serving folks?
Absolutely. So we have relocated to the business capital of the southeast of the country about 6 years ago from being outside of New York City for 72 years. So we are turning 73 years old this year. And we educate young people in high school and college on economics, on ethics, on political philosophy. Everything that you can imagine goes into how you understand the world and how you can work in it.
And a part of the mission, though, is very kind of pro-business, entrepreneurship-centered.
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely. We teach the role of entrepreneurship in the economy. And so it's not just starting a business to make a lot of money for yourself, although that's important. It's all about serving other people well. That's the only way that you can turn a profit in business.
And that not everybody kind of either agrees with that or understands that's how business works.
It's a difficult concept sometimes to explain, but what we find is when our students come to our programs that they're already primed to listen to that kind of message. They see entrepreneurship as a force for good in the world.
And then so your mission is to get them young and kind of create a foundation for them that is maybe competing with some of the things they're learning in other places?
It's definitely competing with things that they're learning and many times not learning in school. How many classes of economics do you expect are being taught in high school these days? And I'll tell you, it's not very many. And when they do teach it, they don't really teach it from a perspective that you can actually have an economy that's not planned from the top down. You can have entrepreneurs planning it from the bottom up.
Now, why do you think that a lot of people are comfortable for the concept of somebody in an ivory tower knows better than me and they'll figure out all this stuff rather than just kind of trust the chaos of the individuals out there?
Lee, we've got a term for that trust that many people seem to have, and that's expertitis. Mm-hmm. People seem to think that just because you've got a degree in something that you understand exactly how that kind of discipline applies to their life. And what we talk about is a concept called spontaneous order, which was actually pioneered by a Nobel laureate in economics named Friedrich Hayek. And he talked about how people actually going, striving toward their own aims can actually produce great social ends for everybody.
And then is that a theory or is there kind of evidence that supports that?
There's evidence that supports that in every way, because when you look at the economies that are most free, that are most least planned, the least planned economies in the world, you see that their economic growth is much superior to those places that have a top-down kind of regime, such as a controlled economy as the former Soviet Union, and even today in places like China where you do have some semblance of a capitalist economy. You have some idea of entrepreneurs coming in and creating value for people, but it's still very much planned from the top down. And so what do you do when an expert doesn't foresee the type of product or good or service that some number of the population would like to see in a couple of years? Well, I'm sorry, it's not part of the five-year plan, so it doesn't fit in.
Now, a lot of people fear that if there are companies out there and they kind of put a label of them greedy or they're exploiting resources and that some people are going to be left behind and who's going to help that person that's not typically part of a business model is helping kind of the less fortunate.
A lot of people tend to talk about social responsibility and what they're doing to help in charitable kind of senses. But what I like to talk about with free market capitalism is it's the least imperfect kind of economic system we have. Yes, it's still imperfect, but it's the system that we've discovered that best serves the needs of the most people in the economy. And so you're not going to reach utopia. That's one of the sort of myths that we dispel from our students' minds whenever they first come to our programs, go to our website, fee.org, watch our videos on YouTube and various other media, is that there's no way to reach a perfect system. And so what's the second best alternative to that? What's the least imperfect? And yes, it's not a system where people are going to find that every need is met all the time. But what's the alternative to that?
Now, are you finding that some of the free market people are embracing, at least adding this other stakeholder of the community as part of their mission. Is that kind of congruent with your thinking, or is that adjacent to your thinking?
I think it's both. It's consistent, at least, I'll say. Congruent or adjacent, either. So there's a group that we work with occasionally called Conscious Capitalism that was founded by, of all many people, John Mackey, who is the founder of Whole Foods. And he'll talk about how companies do have a responsibility not only to their shareholders, but also to their stakeholders. Who are a company's stakeholders? Are they their employees, also their shareholders, their clients, people in the community surrounding? And so all of that is compatible. Whatever you call it, you're only able to turn a profit in a business if you serve other people well.
Now, is your work only in America, or is it global?
We do occasionally go abroad for various programs, but it's primarily here in the U.S. We do seminars across the country.
Now, when you're working in America, are you seeing more people embracing this concept? You've been around 72 years, or is there kind of a pendulum that swings back and forth to sometimes America wants kind of more let the individual do what they will and let's let it play out, or sometimes they go the other way where like, no, this is out of control. We got to help all these people. We got to build some systems.
I think you're spot on, Lee. It's a pendulum. It's definitely a thing. When Fee was founded back in the 40s, this was sort of coming out of the post-World War II economy and the whole era of planning for winning the war, right? And so John Maynard Keynes, one of the great economists of that era, tried to figure out, you know, how do we end up boosting demand in a economy that is depressed, right? And so the war, in many cases, people think actually brought us out of the depression. I tend to disagree with that. But what the climate was at that moment was, well, maybe what worked in the war will work in peacetime too. And so today we're dealing with a very separate set of issues, among them inequality that people have marked as an issue, poverty that people have marked as an issue, environmental concerns. And so we address all of those in a very free market capitalist kind of context, which is very different from what Fee needed to do at the beginning.
Now, sometimes the villain from the free market side is government and regulation, things like that. Do you find also an adjacent villain is some of these super large companies that are business but have grown to be such size and have such power and influence that they can influence government to do the things that they want them to do?
They could indeed. And in fact, one of the concepts that we teach at our seminars is a notion that I'm going to throw this term at you. It's called regulatory capture. It's when the regulations and the bureaus and the various departments in government that have tried to design policies to keep government or to keep rather business in check actually get captured by the very businesses they're trying to regulate. And so what they do is they actually regulate their competitors out of business. And so In the end, it's actually those big businesses that have huge lobbying arms using the power of government to be able to get their way, which is not the way that in a free market capitalist system you would want to see things happen.
Now, you see that a lot in some of these governmental licensing programs, right?
Absolutely. There's a ton of occupational licensing across the country for everything from building coffins to flossing and actually wearing down horses' teeth. And an interior design, florist arranging, everything from those different areas seems to be game for various organizations that are active in those industries to try to use the power of government to lock their competitors out of the marketplace.
So then that's also kind of a villain in your world as well, these kind of large bureaucracies that are just kind of having undue influence over the individual.
Absolutely. But the trick of it is the less you ask and expect the government to do, the less it's going to be able to be co-opted by these forces, these special interests. And so that's the only way, in our opinion, you're going to be able to get the undue influence of these special interests out of the game.
Now, what do you say to the people that are that say things like, well, if you just let business kind of do whatever they want, they're going to make it the cheapest and it'll poison the waters and do kind of damage to the individual?
Yeah, well, when you look at the places in the world that are let's take environmental concerns as the example, the cleanest have the cleanest water, the cleanest air. They also so happen to be, it's not a coincidence, those places with the most developed economies. And the places with the most developed economies happen to be, it's no coincidence, the place where people actually can address the needs of the customer without having a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan given from on high. And so, again, when you look at the concerns that most people have, most of our students, they're concerned about poverty, inequality, environmental concerns, college costs, cost of healthcare. All these things can be addressed in a way that's not top down, it's bottom up. And that's the way that our economy has become the greatest in the world, the biggest in the world. And unfortunately, that's not really the way that I think most people are thinking these days. It needs to continue.
Now, is there a place for some regulation? Like where, like you're saying that this is the second best system.
The least imperfect.
The least imperfect system. How do you, at some point there is a place for rules, right?
Certainly.
You're not saying this is just anarchy and it's every man for himself.
Well, I mean, there's a we at FEE have an ecumenical approach to this. So we'll have a wide tent. Some people might actually say that no government at all happens to be the most effective and efficient and socially prosperous solution. I tend to be a little bit more on the sense of what we call a night watchman state, the kind of state that in government that can actually adjudicate disputes. So they have a judicial system, actually have a national defense, have a police, and maybe some other kind of public safety kind of apparatus. But the dirty little secret about markets and the way that markets work, and it's not just supply and demand, it's, again, serving people well and therefore turning a profit, is that they are actually self-regulated in many ways. I'm not going to sit here and argue that you don't need to have certain standards for the amount of pollution that a car is going to emit, or maybe that there don't need to be rules about dumping stuff into lakes or water otherwise. But the market actually does have a fabulous way of regulating itself, and especially today when you have cell phones that can be more powerful in your pocket than the computer that launched the space shuttle, you have the ability to connect with people and actually see what businesses are doing and criticize them for practices that you find them to be doing bad work on. So I think, yes, there's a place for regulation. I think it needs to be much more limited than it is today. And I think that people don't give as much credit to the fact that people, us, you and me, actually regulate the functioning of the economy much, much more effectively than a government bureaucracy that doesn't know what you or I think about a situation.
Now, are there other countries that have this free market? Are there kind of test cases where a country has said, okay, we're going to go all in on this and then we're going to give this a go, less regulation? Or is that just inherently part of humans that they want to kind of have power and control?
I think it is an inherent part of humans that we want to look to experts to figure out our problems, and there will always be problems, so we need to admit that first. But there are many places in the world, such as Hong Kong, where the notion of a free market economy has been the rule rather than the exception. Hong Kong has extremely free trade, meaning that they'll bring in anything, they'll sell anything with very low tariffs or other protectionist type of measures. There are various employment rules there that make it fairly easy for people to be hired and to be fired. And so if you look at places that, again, top the lists of the most economically prosperous in the world, Hong Kong will definitely be at the top of that. America's not doing too well these days. We've at times slipped into the 20s in the economic most free countries list in the past, and hopefully we'll be able to recover that, but we've definitely not been moving in the right direction. Let's look at places like Hong Kong.
Now, for you, when you're talking to young people, at what age do you start kind of having conversations with the young people?
Certainly. So we'll start truly in earnest with our programs at age 14. So when they go into high school, ninth grade, yeah.
So now is it part of the high school program, or you're, being free market, you're not really want to affiliate with the schools directly and you want to go to the individual directly?
Oh, we would love to affiliate with the schools. The problem is that they very rarely want to affiliate with us. But we do have a great network of teachers that we have using various materials that we've developed. We have a workshop called Economics in One Day that actually takes students through various economic and ethical principles in a single day. But we work mostly with teachers in private schools, parochial schools. We try to get more into the public school system. We have a one-day program that goes out to many public schools. And so we're edging in that direction, but it's hard, especially when you've got curricula that are, again, designated from on high.
Now, one of the examples of one of the first places I found you was this iPencil.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
iPencil. iPencil. It's an autobiography as told from the pencil's point of view. And it was actually written by our founder, Leonard Reed, 50 years ago, actually, last month. And he talks about how something as simple seeming as a pencil, right? You use it every day.
You take it for granted.
You take it for granted. It's miraculous, the fact that all these different parts came together to produce something that you buy for such a trifling sum. You sit there and you wonder, how did this come to be? Could I do this? No, not a single person in the world can bring all the resources together, marshal all the things needed to make a pencil. In fact, people have tried doing this in the past, and they've tried to make things such as toasters. You can actually look this up on YouTube. You can see the person who tried to make a toaster. It took something on the order of 5 months and $2,000 for him to produce something to toast a couple slices of bread. The same thing with a pencil. This whole parable, from the pencil's point of view, talks about how all people across the world, from places where they're felling trees to mining the ore for the brass ferrule to figuring out how to get the material on the inside to it's not lead, but it's graphite, how they mine that, how they get all the eraser material. This isn't happening by accident. This isn't happening because everyone feels benevolent toward you to make a pencil. It's because they're actually looking out for their own self-interest, and they end up creating something that is so much greater than themselves. It's a fabulous essay, and it's available on fee.org, F-E-E.org.
Now, what was the rationale from moving from the north to the south?
Well, I'll tell you what. If you had a mansion from the 19th century that cost $250,000 a year to maintain, I think you'd be looking to move out of there as well.
It also took 7 years?
It took about 67 years for us to get out of there, yeah. So we ended up moving down to Atlanta a few years ago. For many reasons, one of which was we changed our mission from being sort of generalists in teaching free market economics and the principles of the freedom philosophy to teaching high school and college students. And so we needed to be in a place that was easy for people to get to and for us to travel from. And so Atlanta, you know, the brilliant place it is within a 2-hour flight of 80% of the U.S. population. And so we find this is a prime place for us to be. And it's not that we only do all of our events here, but we go all around the country. So it's very easy for us to get from place to place. This also happens to be my hometown,
so
which
that
is
worked
a
out.
Cool coincidence.
So now, part of what you do is you have chapters around the country?
We don't quite have chapters. No, we work more with influencers, people like Boy Scout leaders, junior achievement leaders, teachers, otherwise.
So individuals that are in the organizations that have some leverage.
Exactly.
And so then that's the way you kind of evangelize and spread the word about your mission?
We need people who are going to tell folks to look to us for cool experiences, cool events. We have a huge event coming up here from June 13th through 15th called FeeCon. It's going to be our third annual. We have 800 people coming to that event to learn about all of these ideas. And so that's one of the big things that we need our evangelists and our influencers to talk about is all the neat stuff that we have to offer.
And then do you partner with businesses as well, or is this kind of individually driven?
It's mostly individually driven. We wouldn't pass up the opportunity to partner with businesses, but most of our partners happen to be other organizations that have good constituencies of young people, students. And so we work with a lot of nonprofits, a lot of groups that are similarly minded, plus minded toward talking to young people about entrepreneurship.
So you must be encouraged by all the entrepreneurship centers popping up, all the entrepreneurship degrees now you can get in university.
Oh, absolutely. It's so funny whenever someone talks about studying entrepreneurship, because I wonder sometimes, can you actually study entrepreneurship, or do you just have to do it? And in fact, when I lived in Chicago, I actually just did it and found out how difficult it was to actually get all the paperwork done and meet payroll. I mean, it's tough. And these guys who are going to be talking to you next year will be able to speak to that, too. It's not a cakewalk. And so teaching entrepreneurship is, I think, a bit of a misnomer. You kind of have to just do it.
Yeah, I think that every politician should make a payroll.
Yeah, I agree.
I think they would look at their job a little differently if they had the pressure of a payroll.
It certainly puts a different spin on things.
So now if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
I've mentioned a couple times our website, fee.org, F-E-E.org. And from there, you'll be able to see all of our presence on Facebook, on YouTube, in the classroom. We've got a great selection of resources, books, videos, articles daily. We have a daily email list you can sign up for. Everything is available on fee.org. We'd love to have you there.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much, Lee.
Well, keep up the good work, man. Congratulations on what you've already accomplished, and I'm thrilled that you're based right here. And if there's anything at all that we can do with the Business Radio X Network to get the word out about your efforts and support what you're doing, I think Lee and I are... You're talking to a pretty simpatico crowd here, aren't you, Lee?
Absolutely.
We'd love to take you up on that, Stone.
All right. Well, stay with us a little while. We're going to visit with a couple more guests.
Would love to.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the show independent media consultant, Mr. Carl Danbury. Good morning, sir. Good
morning, Stone. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, Carl, what have you been up to? You have quite the resume of media, being in media here in Atlanta. You've seen the kind of the evolution of the media.
Well, now he's hit the pinnacle, right?
Now he's independent. You know, Richard can appreciate that. Now that's as good as it gets is being independent.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had so many years of being part of the media landscape in Atlanta and beyond. And now I get to tell stories of people that I really feel moved to tell those stories by myself. So it's quite an interesting concept of once having an editorial staff to, like with Points North Atlanta, and now being able to totally go it alone. So I get to choose my projects, and I get to tell their stories. So it's been a little bit of a transition from what it once was, putting out a monthly magazine for 222 yeah. months or something like that consecutively. But now it's interesting. So I'm currently telling stories about a lady that grew up with learning disabilities, and now she's going to be part of a major corporation that her family owns. And so it's very, very interesting. And that's what I enjoy doing is telling stories that few people know about.
Those kind of unsung hero stories?
Love the backstory. Uh-huh. Love the people who you wouldn't recognize as somebody, a mainstream type person, not an entertainer necessarily, but if they are an entertainer in an industry like bluegrass music, for example,
right?
Not generally widely known.
So now for you, now there is kind of no word count anymore, right? There's
always a word count, unfortunately, but you know, you do have parameters that you can work in that are a little bit freer than they once were. So
now, are you finding it? Like, what's the biggest challenge when you go independent? It what is it? Is it getting the person to agree to be interviewed? Is it to have the place that can distribute the content?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting because being a publicist is what I generally would call myself today. Being able to tell the story, you still have to have the outlet. Mm-hmm. And so what you find is, like I worked for the Atlanta Blaze professional lacrosse team this past summer. They have a platform for me to distribute their messaging.
Right.
When you're independent, you don't necessarily have that platform unless you create that platform. And so being able to create it, all of us now in today's media, and you know this as well as anybody, is you have to be your own content provider. Yeah. Richard knows this too. Richard has to spread the word. He has to create his own content so that people know who they are, what their mission is, who they serve.
So now, you know, back in the day, there were less media outlets, right? There was fewer places for stories to be told. And now it's literally infinite. Right, like every individual is a media outlet for all practical purposes.
There's six of us in the room.
Right, and each have a platform. At least maybe more than one.
Right, each of us could create their own platform.
But we each have. I mean, we are each online in some manner. We each are the media.
Right, social, otherwise. So that's the difficult thing. That's the difficult part of the landscape is.
But what makes that difficult?
Who do you trust? Who do you trust to spread your message? Who do you are you going to go on Yelp for your restaurant review, or are you going to go with somebody, listen to somebody's opinion who's actually done restaurant reviews for 20 or 30 years, and listen to their opinion?
Right. Well,
which is more valid in your mind?
That's a great question. So which is more valid in the layperson's mind?
I think that someone with the training, someone with the education, someone with the background of how to present both sides of the story is very important. And I think that we've lost that. I think that not being able to look at it objectively and say, for instance, the chef had a bad day. So am I not going to go back to that restaurant because he had a bad day? Or am I going to go back and give him another opportunity when he didn't have a bad day?
But isn't objective in the eye of the beholder?
Of course.
I mean, everybody's definition of objective is different. There Absolutely. Isn't, there isn't an objective. Like,
right, but objectivity in media is crucial, and we've lost much of that. We're now cheerleaders more than we are objective reporters.
And then, so how do you solve that?
You retrain the way that people think about how they consume the media. Are we going to put emphasis on those who have been trained over a period of time, or are we going to just listen to everybody's opinion?
But what's happening now, in my opinion, is that it's kind of everybody's just picking teams, and then you're listening to your team.
No question. And that also is crucial that we get away from, because if I'm always listening to the right, then I have no compassion for the left. If I always listen to the left, I have no relationship with the right. That's an issue. I think we need to be more centrist when it comes to the media.
So there's no easy way out of this mess, though, right?
No, we've created I mean, we've created
this,
a huge problem.
I mean, I'd like Richard to chime in on this. This is part of the deal with having independence, right? I mean, to me, this is it seems polarizing, but in some ways to me, but also it seems that this is just kind of a ramification. If you give every single person a kind of a bullhorn and say, okay, say what you feel.
It's definitely different from anything we've ever had before, but I think I agree that we definitely want to have news media projected in the most objective way possible. The question is, you know, in a free society, yes, everyone has voice, but doesn't everyone also have the responsibility to be educated about issues, to be able to sort of go through these different things and figure out what is valuable, what is true?
But isn't it on the individual to educate themselves so then they can make that informed decision?
That's totally right. That's totally right. We've lost a lot of that because we have a lot of people in media positions of influence who can go in and just say their opinion and it comes across as fact.
Right. And when you continue to rely upon snippets of information, talking points of information, rather than the complete story, we've dumbed it down so much for people to consume the media that all they have to do is click a button, listen, or watch. There's no investigation whatsoever on their part. And because there's no investigation, they take everybody's word. You've heard it before. It must be true. It's on the internet.
Right, but I've also heard that on the internet, no one knows I'm a dog, you know. So, like,
but his point is well taken. So, like, Richard is very articulate, and I happen to agree with 110% of everything he says. I'm not going to fact check him because everything he's saying is what I already agree with. Right? I mean, so I do need to take maybe some more personal account. Maybe I should be fact checking Richard, right?
But that's the thing, is how many emails have you received from friends who say, I'm forwarding this email because I think it's going to be interesting for you to read? You don't go to Snopes and try to figure out what's true, what's not. You just say, hey, I got this email. It was fascinating. Did you know?
Right. And if then, I get it from Lee, then it's gold.
Right.
Right? So, I mean,
I mean, to me, this is a we're. I remember back in the day, it used to be we were struggling with let the buyer beware or not. And now we're in a buyer beware kind of pendulum swing where the individual has to be more held more accountable to just do this kind of work.
That's absolutely true.
That we can't trust entities to be watching our back because a lot of times the entities have an agenda.
Right. Well, here's the thing is when we grew up, my era, close to your era, maybe not so much those guys. However, you took things that you read in the New York Times and things that you read in the Washington Post and things that you read in the Wall Street Journal as factual.
Walter Cronkite said it. I mean, it might as well have been God sending lightning bolts down there, right?
So we felt like there were no media with agenda at that point in time. That started to change in mid-60s as we started to comment on our participation in the Vietnam War, for example. Now Walter Cronkite has a way to say, this is preposterous. Why are we there? People started to listen to that. 60 Minutes, same thing. So from that point in time to where we are now, it's still 180 degrees, but it's 180 degrees worse in my view, because I think that what you've done is you've legitimized people and their opinion for not being necessarily factually based.
You got a big job in front of you.
Huge.
I mean, this is. I mean, it makes me feel real good about being in the business that we're in, because we get a chance to follow this and challenge it and everything else. But you've got a heck of a job in front of you.
Well, I do, but the thing is, so do you. And the reason that you started doing what you're doing is because you didn't like what you saw in the landscape from media, the pay per play.
Right. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right about that.
And since 2005, 2006, when you started, the pay for play is at its absolute worst right now.
Is that right?
Well, absolutely. Yeah.
That was a big deal to us. That was a big major red line we did not want to cross, right, Lee?
That was one of the kind of core foundational things in our organization. But also, I was tired of having the business person be the bad guy and the villain.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't see anybody in the landscape that was telling the stories of these small to mid-sized business owners that are out there battling that, to me, are the core of the economy. And nobody was cheerleading for them. Nobody was telling, not even giving them space to tell their story. And the only time a business person would get airtime was if they paid, or coincidentally, they ran big ads and all of a sudden now there's articles about them.
Or scandal.
Or there was a fire or a crime or they did something horrible.
Right.
So then, because of the ramifications of that, and I'm sure Richard can attest to this, is you have a bunch of young people who think business and going into business is not a good, noble pursuit.
Who's the bad guy in the movie, right? The greedy businessman, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, here's the thing is, you look at it from my perspective. When we opened up Points North Atlanta in 2000, the only magazine in the area that was really worth its salt at all was Atlanta Magazine. Atlanta Magazine was part of a network of publications. So they had Indianapolis, they had L.A., they had several different magazines that helped prop up exactly what they were doing, right? So we're an independent publisher publishing one title, and we're trying to do business against that kind of platform. It wasn't easy. So from a small business perspective, there's no question Atlanta Magazine is definitely still classified as a small business, but there are levels to the small business.
Right. It's small, again, is in the eye of the beholder.
Right, exactly.
So now, this was good stuff, but let's talk about the important stuff. Let's talk about Shamrockin' for a Cure.
Well, this is a fascinating story. And the fascinating story is that it came about because of two children that were diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. And nobody knows basically what cystic fibrosis is. It's just a horrendous, horrible lung disease, but it only affects about 30,000 people in the United States. So it's not a widespread type disease. But these kids can't breathe. These kids have to take pills and pills and pills and more pills. And even if they work, they have to do lung treatments. They have to do breathing treatments. Every day, I mean, we've seen kids who, you look at Richard's coffee, you look at Lee's coffee cup, there are some people that take as many pills that can fit in that coffee cup in one day. And over a period of time, that costs lots and lots of money, and that costs lots and lots of heartache. So About 11 years ago, Pam and John Baker, who live in East Cobb, they were sitting around the coffee table with friends, and they were talking about their kids. What are we going to do about the kids? Life expectancy at that time was about 30 years at the most, if you're lucky. Now, research funding has kind of crept that up to maybe 35, 39. So this is one of those impactful charitable organizations that your money actually has created medicines that help these kids breathe again. So every one of us who got involved with Shamrocking for the Cure was basically recruited. And it's a friend network is all it is. So in North Fulton, all these friends got together and said, we're going to throw a party and we're going to try to raise funds. So Tom Murphy, who was one of the friends that got involved, basically carried the mission of the first event 11 years ago and bought every silent auction item that was up for grabs. So he alone basically enabled us to go to the second year. Now, during the course of the past 10 years, they've raised more than $4 million for the cure.
And it started grassroots, just individuals saying, look, something's got to be done and I'm going to do it.
They were at a coffee table, they were drinking wine, and they decided to throw a party. And now the party is in its 11th year, and they have a great band every year. They have live auction, they have silent auction, they've got 30 restaurants that come and provide the food, and plenty of Tito's vodka and Angel's Envy bourbon and that kind of thing to get people excited about the auction.
And where is it at this year?
It's at the amphitheater, which on Encore Parkway, which has been renamed Ameris Bank Amphitheater. Uh-huh. It used to be Verizon.
Right.
So Ameris Bank is now the main sponsor, and I think it's March 23rd, Saturday, March 23rd, 2019.
Is there a website for them?
There is, and it's shamrockingforacure.com, and also you can find any kind of the information that you want on Cystic Fibrosis website as well.
Now, for you and your kind of second act of your career now as an independent media consultant, what is how can we help you? What are you looking for? Like,
I'm looking for great subjects to enable me to tell their stories. And I've done it for, like I said.
Before it was cool.
Yeah, exactly. We've been doing it for quite a while, for sure.
So now, and then an interesting story, what does that look like to you?
I'll give you a classic example, and I mentioned the bluegrass musician.
And then what was that? You did some with bluegrass, right? Didn't you go to some festival?
Probably.
Nashville?
Oh, that's a blues festival, and we're going again in into January. That's blues, not bluegrass. But I like both genres.
But I like both genres as well. There's a guy, bluegrass musician, one of the top vocalists in bluegrass for years and years and years. And I found out that he lived in Cumming. And he lives in a very modest home with his wife. And I had no idea.
And he's down the road, right? Like, here's this guy that you look up to and like his music, and he's down the road.
Absolutely. And no one knew that he lived in Cumming. He's been in Cumming since 1991. And here he is, like a top bluegrass musician and vocalist, and nobody knows it.
Right. So that's the kind of story.
That's the kind of story that I love. What I like to dig up.
So now if they know somebody or thinks they know somebody or maybe they're the person, how do they get a hold of you?
It's 404-307-6093. And my email is carldanbury58@gmail.com.
And they can connect with you on LinkedIn as well.
Sure.
Carl Danbury. Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Well, thank you for fighting the fight and sharing your story.
Thank you, Lee. I appreciate it.
Hey, stay with us. We got one more guest we're going to visit with.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right, Lee, let's bring in the headliner.
All right.
You ready for that?
Game on.
Okay. Let's have with us product manager with Workful, Mr. Dennis O'Keefe. Have you learned anything this morning listening in on these conversations?
I tell you what, yeah, this was kind of a blast, and I was really hoping that when Carl got started, someone was going to say the answer to the problem with media would be more government regulation, and then I was going to watch Richard's head explode, and we'd bump the ratings up a bit. But that was two incredible stories, and I really appreciate being here to hear them.
Well, tell us about Workful. How are you serving folks?
Sure. So Workful is payroll and employee management software for what we consider the underserved in the small business markets, for the very small companies with 4 to 25 employees is kind of our sweet spot, who don't have a whole lot of holistic software packages catered directly to them.
So what is that person doing now, or what's that organization do if they don't have Workful?
If they don't have Workful, they're typically implementing several solutions. They're probably working off, and let me explain a little bit more about Workful is to kind of give you some context. So what Workful provides is streamlined processes for your day-to-day employee interactions with the company, whether that's your timesheets, your PTO tracking, expense and mileage reports, and all rolls up into the engine behind the product, which is payroll. So you're not having to integrate with multiple systems or, let's say, track out of office on Outlook and then track your timesheets on a spreadsheet or on a different solution. It's all in one place. So you're learning one solution, paying for one solution, and it's at a pretty friendly price for these size companies.
Does it include any type of benefits, like insurance or anything like that?
We don't, no. This is more based on those day-to-day employee interactions.
What about contract employees?
We do, yeah. We support contract employees. I mean, you have to. At this point in the small business landscape, there's typically at some point in every company's life cycle where they are either completely paying contractors as employees or they have some portion of their employees who are being paid as contractors. So, we support that as well.
Now, you mentioned that you're going after kind of this small business, and like Carl said earlier, small businesses in the eye of the beholder.
Sure.
How many businesses, like, meet your profile, like in Georgia? Is it a larger number than maybe people understand?
It's stark. So I believe there's about 900,000 small businesses in Georgia.
Small defined as under how many employees?
I believe the definition is under 500 is the definition.
That's number one is
right. So we're looking at more micro, but 97% of those companies have less than 100 employees. So that is a massive body of businesses just in Georgia. And now Georgia, it maybe isn't comparative to all the rest of the states. I think we're number three for small businesses right now.
Number three in terms of the number of small businesses?
And it's some rating, like the ease of doing small business right. in a state. So we may have a leg up right now. And I know the economy here is booming pretty well. But that's still, if you would kind of stretch that across the nation, that's a whole lot of companies that are kind of in this target audience.
Now, for you, are your companies, are they service industry? Are they, manufacturing? Like, what does the companies actually look like?
There's a lot of it's going to be service industry, but we also fit pretty well for professional firms, business service providers. And I'll give you a little backstory there, if you want. We're actually owned by a parent company called TaxSlayer, which is out of Augusta, Georgia. I don't know if y'all have heard of TaxSlayer. It's a individual tax filing online as well as professional software.
They do college bowls too, right?
They do, yeah. The Gator Bowl. That's right, the TaxSlayer Gator Bowl down in Jacksonville, which was a good game this year. So back in the 80s, it was just a mom-and-pop tax office. They wanted some tax software. What was on the market wasn't great. They built it, started using it. They started giving it to their buddies, started selling it, now support thousands of tax offices across the country. And in the past 25 years, we've had these tax offices have a whole lot of other needs. They've got clients they're serving. Right. They have employees. And they're all typically between 1 and 10 tax preparers in an office. So over that course, we've built payroll software and accounting software to support them. And through those dealings, year in and year out, we've kind of learned what the essentials are for them, and have also understood that they haven't been able to find solutions that really fit the bill for them.
Because they're too small.
They're too small.
It doesn't fit in,
right.
Or it's too expensive. Maybe there is a solution, but it would be too expensive for a company.
That's right. That's right. So if you look at a enterprise-type solution, that will have a few more bells and whistles. You're talking about six-figure implementation, and that's just obviously not practical
right.
for a small shop.
So now, how'd you get involved with them?
I actually came on probably 6 years ago to sell as a sales representative to for the tax offices to sell software.
For a tax
to them.
Lawyer.
That's right. And in doing that kind of worked into kind of the point guy for the business solutions that we were building over time, and really enjoyed it and really love small business. I've got a small business myself. I'm in construction. We do houses and rentals and flip properties. And I've got a lot of passion for it. So I love being able to build something that makes a difference in a small business owner's life.
So now, how's your sales and marketing work? Is this something like, how do you get on their radar?
We do, it's kind of a two primary legs. We do trade shows across the country. Like we went to the SHRM conference in Chicago last year. We went to the Small Business Expo in Atlanta last year, which was great. So we've got boots on the ground, trying to get out there and get it directly to the people. And then digital marketing. We've got campaigns going on across the country.
So you're creating kind of inbound leads through that.
That's right. That's right.
So now, when the person is using you, is this their first kind of move to a software? Like, because like you said before, they're kind of cobbled together some
mm-hmm.
solutions, or are they dealing with like kind of one of those payroll services and then they're handling it?
It's kind of a 50-50, and I think the stat right now is that 50% of small businesses are still working off paper checks and are still doing a lot of processes by hand. So we get both sides of that. We get people coming from major payroll companies or their banks are handling their payroll. And then people who have been running a spreadsheet or like we were talking about the 1099 contractors are just cutting straight checks and filing 1099s at the end of the year.
So walk me through what like an onboarding would look like. Like say I'm using one of those payroll services
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to switch to Workful.
Sure, sure. So we would have, you would have a kind of a phone call and a demo with one of our sales representatives who would kind of make sure that it was a product that fits your needs. And then we'd roll you over to our implementation team, which is our customer support team, who will walk you through the whole process by sharing the computer screen with you, get all your data in there for you. Or a lot of business owners are kind of do-it-yourself folks. They get in there, they plug in all their data, and then come back to us to double-check it and kind of walk them through how everything works together.
So now, once I do that, now it's in the Workful system. Now I cut my payroll company loose. I don't need them anymore. Now Workful is going to do?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Now it's manageable? Like, what's the value proposition to me? When I had that payroll company, I might have paid more, but I don't have to think about it and worry about any of the mistakes and things like that.
We're giving the same value proposition, so you're not having to worry about whether or not the direct deposits are going out. What you're doing is kind of cutting down the time that you did spend reconciling timesheets and out of office and expense reports and sending that to your payroll company
right.
or to your banker or to your CPA. It's all on one platform. When you hit run payroll, it's pulling all that data in. You're looking at the pay stubs to make sure everything's correct
right.
and you're hitting send. So if everything's clicking, this is we're talking about a 5-minute process. Most people will take longer because they want to double check, make
right.
sure things
okay.
are accurate. And of course, you've got the employee that forgets to clock out one day, and
right,
and you got to ping them and say you need to fix your timesheet, which is something the employee can also do in Workful. So we're delivering on that same value proposition. It's pretty hands free. I would never say payroll is totally carefree because it's something that I know keeps business owners up at night, but we try to limit the pain and anxiety that comes with managing employees and running payroll.
And then, so when I switch to Workful, it's dramatically less expensive now? Like, what's in it for me?
It could be. It really depends on who you're with now. So we could get you in at under $100 a year per employee. So, and we don't charge the...
Wow.
Yeah, we don't charge the per paycheck or the nickel and dime for this feature and that feature. But you get the whole platform for as little as $8 a month per employee. So if you've got 10 employees, you're talking about under $100 a month to run your payroll, your timesheets, and your expense reports.
Now, for you as an organization, is this the beginning? Are you looking to expand a suite of services?
We are, yeah, absolutely. We're always looking to expand, and this is in its own way kind of an expansion of our
tax layer
and our previous payroll and accounting services. So yeah, absolutely.
So what's on the roadmap? What are some of the things you're looking at?
The roadmap this year is immediately we are looking into getting or we're exploring getting the accounting package on the same platform as we still have a whole lot of users in that software, and we're also looking at getting into a more full service payroll to where you're really setting and forgetting it. You're setting it up on day one, and then end of the year you're receiving a W-2 in the mail.
And then so it's playing nicely with information I give my accountant and and paying my people.
Right, that's correct.
So now for you, what's your goals for 2019? To grow Workful, like how many more, like how, where are you at right now and where do you want to go?
So we're about a year and a half in, and we're hoping to have my goal this year is to have a network of small business service providers that are recommending Workful to their clients. And we just this past fall built a new platform for payroll providers, for CPAs, for anybody providing services to small businesses to either run their clients' payroll through Workful or to refer it to their clients.
So it's the same tax layer model, isn't that their model as well, that they go through CPAs and bookkeepers and things like that?
We've got two models with TaxSlayer. We've got the individual tax filings. You could go to TaxSlayer.com. You could plug in your W-2 information and send off your federal and state tax returns. And then, right, the other model is the mom-and-pop tax offices. I call mom-and-pop. Some of them are very large organizations.
Right.
But the people on the downtown street corners and the storefronts where you can go and get your taxes done by a CPA, right?
So one of your missions, the more CPA firms and bookkeeping firms you know, the better it is.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
The very best way is to go to workful.com and check out the website. And we've got people live ready to chat with you. We've got people ready to hop on the phone with you. Or you could go set up a free account. We do a free 30-day trial. You could go, if you're interested in this type of service, you can kick the tires, see a free demo, see if it's something that would help you out, and give us a buzz.
So what's the pain that this business is having where they would make a switch like this? What just happened that's the trigger?
Well, there's a couple. There are two primaries. One is financial, right? They're paying too much. Perhaps they're paying for four different applications to do what we can do with one.
Right.
And while they're all just a couple bucks here and there, it ends up piling up.
That's how they get you.
That's right. That's right. So that's one avenue that leads people to us. The other is more of a sense of being really on top of your business, providing your employees with a top-notch experience that gives them access to all the tools they need to be engaged with the company. Because not to throw out another stat, but I'm going to 75% of employees say that they are not engaged with their employer, which
That's wow. not good.
It's no, not, that's good. Not good. It's that means if a better offer comes mm-hmm. up, they're jumping ship,
take it, right?
Or if they have a bad day, they might jump ship.
Right.
So, and we also know, being in small business, that it's pretty tough to find qualified workers. So what you want to do is make sure that your employees are having the best experience possible, removing all the tedious, busy work.
Right, and the friction. Right.
Right, and the friction, the non-paid activities, and streamlining that. So when they come to the office, or if they're working off-site, they feel like they are in a professional environment that is looking out for them and helping them be as productive as they can be.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. And one more time, the website?
Workful.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you all for sharing your story today. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We'll see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.